Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. How's everything at OC Talk Radio today for you?
Things are going good. As good as good can be. We're in crazy, turbulent times here. So anytime you have a good day, it's one to remember here.
Yeah, your turbulent times are, this will be after the fact, but the final debate is tonight, so
yes.
You're in great turmoil over that.
I am.
And I'm just in. It's another
You're
show.
Done. You already voted. You're in. They already locked you in already here.
Yeah. Okay, hey, Paul, today our show, I think, is going to take us down a journey down that road less traveled. Today we are going to learn about the value of life from the insights of author and professor Dr. Donna Friis. Donna will talk to us about the value of nostalgia, overcoming childhood tragedy, and her fervent belief that in spite of anything and everything, happiness is a choice. My colleague Barbara Kimmler, a publicist and consultant, recommended that I read Donna's latest book, Growing Up Venice, and then perhaps interview her on the show. Well, after reading her book, I quickly concluded that I must chat with Donna Friis on the next chapter with Charlie. Donna's book not only highlights the fascinating growth and evolution of Venice, California, but it also captured me with a renewed sense of the value of nostalgia, something we seem to have dismissed in our culture that is so full of itself in the present and the future. And then when we do speak of the past, it is most always in the negative. And Donna just offers such a refreshing perspective on this. Dr. Donna Friis is the author of at least 10 books, I tried to count, a retired college professor, a historian, a most avid learner. Her book, Cry in the Darkness, which we will discuss, has been translated into 7 languages. So with that, let's welcome Dr. Donna Friis on the show. Donna, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
I'm very excited to be here, Charlie. I look forward to this all day long. Today was a Zoom day for me. I had a Zoom board meeting, and then the Los Angeles Historical Society offered us a librarian's webinar on old LA photos. So I have had an exciting day already, and to be here with you is even more exciting.
Oh, well, thank you. And I know you told me Los Angeles is sort of your next historical venture is
well,
LA.
The Venice book, of course, Venice is part of Los Angeles.
Of course,
and,
of course.
So that, those tendrils are going. So, so I joined the Historical Society, and I have my grandfather's diploma from high school, and he graduated, and it says Los Angeles City. And I noticed the Historical Society is Los Angeles City Historical Society. We don't really define it that way anymore. So I'm excited for a new venture. What interests me is how one thread, I woke up during this pandemic one morning thinking, oh, my God, how am I going to keep myself more entertained? I'd already taken down window coverings and reorganize things and typed up a family genealogy, and I'd only used up about 4 weeks of our lockdown. And then it came to me about growing up next to oil wells.
Yeah.
So I woke up thinking, I can write about that. This is lost parts of Los Angeles history. So, but now that thread from writing the book is leading me to the Historical Society, and I don't know, I'm pulling these threads, Charlie. It's very fun for me.
Well, tell me something. This your latest book, Growing Up Venice, and I think it's subtitled Parallel Universes, is that right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And to begin with, what prompted you to write this very interesting, what I found was a combination personal memoir and history of Venice, California. What prompted you to get into that subject?
Honestly, I've been writing about anything I can think about. We have a home above Mentone on the backside of Big Bear Mountain. And in the 90s, I collected the stories that the old timers had told me and my college roommate, Janet, who is my neighbor. They had filled us young moms. We were just 29 with all their stories. They were old timers my age now, but they had a sense of preserving the history, and their idea was to tell us young new members the history. So as time passed, and our kids grew up, well, we had time to write up what we knew. And Janet said one day, as we crossed the lawn from my cabin to her cabin, "I'll help you if you'll write it." So I came home and immediately forgot about that commitment. And then this huge stack of research material showed up at my front door. I thought, "Oh, well, Janet certainly hasn't forgotten." So I wrote Whispering Waters with her, and that evolved into a history of the settling of Southern California. So that was my first one. And then I became a docent at Mission San Juan Capistrano 5 years ago now. And I got so excited about the history of the California missions that I was just, what can I do? I don't want to repeat what already has been written about Southern California, or in this case, San Juan Capistrano. What can I do? What can I do? And as I brainstormed, I saw a sign from our local tech store, our longtime equestrian in town, Fred Love, that he was moving away forevermore and closing down a story. And that was it. What could I write about that hadn't already been written about? And so I wrote about the equestrian history, really, of South County, really of Southern California. And my history juices were just flowing. And so that was 2 years ago. And with the pandemic, I've had lots of time. So it just came to me one morning. How many people wake up every single morning of their growing up years next to a working, pumping oil well with a tall derrick on one side, a mansion on the other side? We were in 400 square foot little house, a mansion on the other side, and the waves beating on the sand 20 feet from the front gate. Not too many people. And
yeah, so let me stop you right there, because what I want to talk about, you really prompted an interest in that. You go back 120 to 140 years ago in Venice. And I think not many of us realize that Venice, I think you said, was the second major oil producer in California, that there were 450 oil wells.
Fourth largest oil field in California, yes.
Fourth largest oil field in California.
That's huge.
Yes, yes. That's huge. And did I read correctly that there were 450 oil wells in Venice?
Yes, and the last one was only capped in 1970. Everywhere where Marina del Rey is now, that beautiful, largest man-made marina in the northern hemisphere, that was oil wells. And all along the beach were oil wells. And to add insult to oil wells at the beach, the city of Los Angeles proposed putting oil wells on the beach itself. The beach part of the beach, not just along the perimeter of the beach, but there was a movie star named Lewis Stone, and he had a beautiful house on the waterfront there, and so there was litigation, and they stopped the city from putting oil wells. Their idea was, we've already ruined Venice Beach, so we'll just continue to ruin it, and we'll use the proceeds to buy beachfront somewhere else. Well, Angelinos aren't going to drive up north to go to the beach, that was a silly idea. So Lewis Stone prevailed, but imagine that whole beachfront now, which is very much high-rise condos and beautiful homes. Imagine it just all under oil wells, and then I have all these different pictures I found in my book. It was
your book is filled with photographs that are just fascinating.
Well, there was so much
historical
pollution.
Photographs.
They had to close down the elementary school due to the pollution.
In what year was that?
Well, I moved in the end of the summer in 1945.
And so they closed down in 1945? They closed down?
That's when I moved there. I think the school, it was Nightingale Elementary, closed down for some years in the late 30s. That's how polluted it was.
No way. Now, in spite of all of this, and, you know, so we have oil wells, and you think, all right, this is not going to be a city of tourist attractions, and yet there was the vision of, gosh, I should have written down his name, of building...
Abbot Kinney's vision?
Of his vision of building, making a Venice, Italy into Venice, California with canals. And really quickly, Venice became a very, in spite of the oil fields, became a very popular tourist attraction, wasn't it?
Well, it always was. So even in the late 1800s, it was always very, very popular. And then Abbot Kinney came along and dredged all these canals. He even brought gondoliers in from Italy to sing to the people and to push the gondolas around. It was really elaborate, beautiful hotels, but he wasn't attracting the big family. So then he started bringing in rides like Midway rides and things that would appeal to the family.
Ocean Pier or...
Well, there was Venice Pier, and I have pictures of my great-grandfather posing there in 1908. And then Ocean Park Pier was a mile or so towards Santa Monica, and then Santa Monica Pier. But, Charlie, Santa Monica Pier is still there, but those big piers, that's lost history as well. And they were remarkable. They'd have 60,000 visitors a day and hundreds of thousands of people at the beach and enjoying
it all. What years were those, Donna, that they would have that many visitors?
Abbot Kinney opened July 4th, 1905. It went beautifully and then he had his death in 1920. And so it was still... the whole area was going pretty well, except a fire burned down the pier. And so his poor son, Thornton, had to try to find the funds to rebuild the pier. And Abbot, trying to protect the estate, had tied up any funds being released for 10 years. So Thornton was able to use his good name and rebuild the pier. And it moved along well, but then there was the Depression. And then... World War One and World War Two, but even with that, the military young men came dancing became a craze. It still went, and then all of a sudden, whammo, and I think it was 1946, the city of Los Angeles did not renew the lease on the pier, and that was the beginning of the end of that. And then in the background, a few... you know, not that long, 1950s, Disneyland began to be born and was open, and that was really the end of the big piers there.
But didn't you say in the book, did I read correctly in the book, that Venice Beach was second only to Disneyland in the number of tourists that came to Southern California?
Right now, 10 million a year, right now.
Right now, 10 million
a year. Well, maybe not with COVID. That I mean in
right, of course, and that's
history.
That's due to Venice Beach and all that's going on in Venice
this
Beach.
Yes, the number two tourist attraction in Southern California.
You know, I was a kid, I remember going to, you know, not Ocean Park or Ocean Pier, but Pacific Ocean Park, POP, and I lived maybe 30 miles or more away from it. And I bet we went a dozen times. It was the most spectacular, the funnest place in the world to go to.
In the world. And so Ocean Park Pier morphed into POP.
Oh, is that what it did? So Ocean Park Pier morphed into POP.
You were on the right pier. You were on the Ocean Park Pier, the one between the two, and they put millions of dollars in, and it was an extravaganza, if you remember.
But it only lasted like a decade, didn't it?
I know. Yeah. Disneyland really, you know, times were changing. And also the area was getting really seedy. So
anyway. Was it? Yeah. Was it?
Yeah.
So before we move on to our next idea, just tell me, what is your fondest memory of Venice? I know I'm not talking about specific, but sort of a gestalt, sort of a big picture. What do you remember Venice for growing up? Venice, what do you remember it for?
I think now, as a grandmother myself, the most beautiful memory I have is the idea of living on the edge of the continent and having literally hundreds of thousands of miles of ocean and sand, and to imagine living on the edge of a continent and the freedom. As I've written this book, my friends are all saying, we were free too. We were latchless kids, not latchkey kids. We just needed to be home by the time the street lights turned on. And I heard that over and over. And I just think the freedom to wander and, find the 4th of July fireworks the next day and set off the sparklers, the freedom of roaming, I think that's my fondest memory.
That is, it's funny. That is exactly, that was my takeaway. You know, Donna, in a sense, we are contemporaries in that we were raised with many similar values and experiences in our youth. And the deeper I got into your book, the more I found myself longing for those days in my life, which was not on the beach, yes. Was in landlocked Pico Rivera. You know, we didn't lock our front doors. Kids knew when it was time to come home, when the streetlights came on. We played games that concluded with phrases like ollie, ollie, oxen free. And we were truly free children to do whatever, because we would stay on our block. We wouldn't stray off. We wouldn't go away unless we told our parents. And so we were within, for us, we were within, always within a couple hundred yards of our home. And there was this delightful freedom. I like the term your kids used, unlatched kids, unlocked.
Latchless kids. And we're clear down in South Orange County now, and there were only 7,000 people in San Juan Capistrano when we got down here. And my kids, who are 40s and 50s now, were free to roam as well. So it was a wonderful way to grow up. And I feel really grateful that I was able to let my kids have an environment like that where they could roam free. But talk about nostalgia. So I was interviewing people for my book. Well, what else do you remember? I found people who grew up in Venice, and the Helmstra kept coming up and helped. So I
remember that in Pico Rivera.
They told me it went as far as Fresno, and then they said, no, it came to San Diego where we lived, and people were so excited about the cream puffs and the eclairs.
Right.
So I wrote, I have a blog that...
No, that was for your rich people. I just got regular glazed donuts.
Oh, you did? Oh, well, my grandpa would buy me a cream puff, and that's still my favorite thing. But I put a blog out. I have a blog to the different people who follow me, and I got more long stories back for telling about the Helms, just that little part about the Helms, that memory. People, it really struck a nerve with them about the Helms truck. Isn't that sweet?
That really is. So Donna, what do you think? What is it that, at least for you and me and your children and so many others, what makes nostalgia so pleasant? Because I've never thought of it. As an aside, I took, during COVID, when we were in the total lockdown, I took a trip to my hometown, to Pico Rivera, and visited my elementary, junior high school, my hangout. We used to cruise Whittier Boulevard. I cruised Whittier Boulevard. And I can't exactly describe the emotion, but it was extremely
warm. It's a warm emotion.
Warm and fun and
warm.
Friendly. And,
I mean,
and we
fun.
Just, and perhaps your idea of freedom, we had a sense of freedom. There were strict parental controls, but we were on our own, and it was up to us to honor that freedom. What do you think, What do you think about nostalgia that is so pleasant?
And I agree with you. We made, during the worst of the lockdown, we made 5 trips up to Venice, and that included parts that weren't Venice. So we went to Santa Monica High, where I went, Venice High School, and Mark Twain Junior High, the different places in my old neighborhood. And I was, and my girlfriend's house is still there. The freeway took our house, so, you know, I couldn't really go back to the house in Culver City where we lived. And, of course, the house in Venice, where I lived, that it's a huge condo now. But I don't know just what it is, but it pulls something in our brain of fondness. But I experienced this, Charlie. So my husband and I did the 5 trips. So he pulled in a place and just kept the car running. And I went to the front gate where our house used to be. It's a condo. It's a 3-lot condo, a huge multi-story condo. I stood in the exact same spot where our front gate would have opened. And in those days, it wasn't a half-mile long beach. It was, you know, 20 or 30-foot beach. The waves were right there. In fact, the house next door had severe storm damage. The waves were that close at one point. But as I stood there, this feeling came over me, this incredible feeling of peace. And I haven't experienced that before. And then I got back in the car, and I didn't share that with my husband, because honestly, it was such a remarkable feeling of peace that came over me, and the wind kind of ruffled my hair. And I kept it to myself until I was writing this book, and then I was able to articulate it. And I can't really account for it, but
I get it. I had the same feeling when I went back to PR. That's our short term for Pico Rivera. Right. I went back to PR, and I was able to drive by the house that I was raised in,
right.
and it is so small, but I just had such warm, you know, I wasn't struck by the size of it. I was just struck by the warmth of it. And then I was able to drive a mile down the road to the baseball fields that I played at between 9 and 12 years old. And there's still the high wires that I hit a home run over, that I remember that. And it was such a warm, peaceful feeling. And it reminded me, even with difficulties at the time, there were just such wonderful, beautiful times of youth that was so pleasant. Talk about this later, that we only look at the past in the negatives. We only look at the troubles that we had in the past and whatever they may be. We live in this convoluted, very troublesome present with little hope for the future, but that's where we're focusing. I mean, there is a hope for the future, but right now you're feeling like there's not hope for the future. And I fear for the children now. What are the children of COVID going to look at, Donna? I mean, what do they have to look at the pleasantries of childhood?
They're on the screen. I mean, I've got 11 grandchildren, and they're doing Zoom all day long. My daughter's a 7th grade English teacher, and I mean, she's talking to the void. Please turn on your camera, Nathan. But they don't really respond back. They're
but it's
shy.
Not the same. It's not the same, is
not
it?
The
and
same.
And they're
uh-uh.
they're not out like we were. We were playing baseball, playing hide and seek, swimming. We had a neighbor that had a swimming pool, and we used to go over to our neighbor's swimming pool. And I remember this at 10, 11 years old, and he was home. He worked a night shift, and he was home during the day. And he would have all the neighborhood kids over, and in order to swim, we had to do his gardening. We had to clean up. We had to clean up all the backyard, rake up everything, sweep everything, and then we got to swim. And there would be half dozen to a dozen of us just having a blast in the pool. And that was right across the street from me. Those were such fond memories. And I feel for the children that don't have fond memories. And what I want to do is I want to take a break, and I want to come to those, because we're going to sort of change topics a little bit here, if you don't mind.
No, I'm great.
Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you are listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. I am visiting a special guest today, Dr. Donald Friese, a historian, college professor, avid learner, author, and just wrote a book that's titled Growing Up Venice in Venice, California. It's talking about the history of Venice, how it went from a nothing town to a tourist town to an oil town to a Muscle Beach town to Silicon Valley South. And it's gone through so many different iterations, and yet it's such a wonderful place. And she has these extremely wonderful memories. And we were talking about the value of nostalgia, and we talked about the value of my nostalgia. But Donna, I have to say that this nostalgia thing begs a question. What about the vast number of people from our past, even, and the recent past, the vast number of people that didn't have such a seemingly idyllic childhood? That the way we're describing childhood is like, we're like a 1950s Jimmy Stewart movie. But you have another tale, don't you?
I do. I do. And I'm very happy that now at the grandmother phase of life, I can look back at Venice so fondly. One of the iterations of Venice, and it's going, it's happening now, the homeless have really invaded Venice. So while we have been in the lockdown and Governor Newsom would not let us go on the beach, even to be active in the early part of our shutdown, the homeless people have their tents pitched on the beach and live there. And it's a problem for Venice. But across time, as we look back in history, the rents got to be low. The canals that Abbot Kinney built began to fill up with silt and sludge. So that became a problem, and the city of L.A. then finally had to fill them in. But a bad element of people moved into areas of Venice, and it was the second in gang violence, second only to Watts for about 40 years in there. So I feel pleased that I have evolved myself to a point to embrace the fact that I have come from Venice, because across my life, it didn't always have the best reputation. So I'm proud of myself about that. But while, yes, I have presented the very most wonderful, rich part of my childhood, simultaneously, I was a victim of pretty severe child sexual abuse. And so I'm proud of myself as a person that I've been able to choose happiness and move forward and have a productive life in light of how devastating that childhood was, and that I could even look back at it and fondly now. But look how far I've evolved from that. I couldn't have done that 30 years ago.
Well, look at your book, Cry in the Darkness, which is translated into 7 languages, and it's about sexual abuse, is it not?
It is. And, my story.
And you have overcome that, but that had to be a process. That, you know, that wasn't an overnight thing. What sort of tools or learnings did you use in order to transform that into the inspiring, fun-loving, positive person that you are, in spite of having absolute the most tragic of circumstances in your childhood? You have a idyllic sounding childhood, yet to live it had to be tragically painful, Donna.
But even while I lived it, I still laughed and had fun. I think a lot of us victims of any kind of childhood devastation, we learn how to compartmentalize. And I had a getaway plan early. And that getaway plan was get my A's, get my degree, get out of Dodge. And I did that. I got out of Dodge and I moved far away to Orange County from the difficulty, and I don't want to sound too heroic here, because my secret would have gone to the grave with me, absolutely, except for the fact that my father continued his molesting, and he was molesting my three-year-old niece, and my half-sister and her adult daughter came to me to stop him. And so I had to tell my husband what had happened across my whole life. Oh, by the way, honey, I forgot to mention this little fact. And so he was not going to, you know, stand idly by. So the authorities were called in. There was a 15-month-long trial, lots of therapy. I enrolled in my doctoral program specifically studying survivors and coping tools, and the whole movement to stop child sexual abuse began about the time my story came out. So a lot of studying, therapy, but deep within the soul of me is the determination that my dad was not going to win, that I am going to have a wonderful, evolved, thrilling, exciting life, period. And I'm having that. And this recent book is simply a facet of me being productive and engaged in something exciting. It was so exciting writing that book and researching it and interviewing people. And I'm just live in a state of excitement when I'm in the middle of a project. So it was determination, I think. But I don't want to sound too heroic here. If there hadn't been a little girl in jeopardy, I would have remained silent.
Did you have anybody that was a role model or that encouraged you at that time? Was there a relative or one of your siblings?
None of them knew any of that. I mean, my poor grandmother would have been horrified if she knew about her darling son. Well, I took my aunt was the dean of women at Pierce College, so I got it about community college and what it offers.
So you went through the majority of your childhood sort of really alone. This was, don't worry about the dogs. We
move.
Yeah, well,
I'm moving.
But that's part of life. But you went through this. It sounds to me like you went through this time alone, that you really didn't have anybody to talk to about it. You just had yourself to figure it out.
Oh, yeah, just myself. Yeah, myself. Who would I talk to? I didn't trust a sibling. I didn't trust anybody. And when I finally told a little crumb to my half-sister whose child was being abused, she did tell Dad. And then he turned it into that I was trying to steal her kid. I mean, I didn't trust anybody for good reason.
So. And how long was that, Donna? I mean, when do you think you overcame?
Well, I was
overcame...
about 45 when we
oh,
finally went to
goodness.
The authorities.
So you held that within, and that's after all of this psychological training, your PhD work, therapy.
Well, the PhD came simultaneously with the trial. So I was able to move to my cognitive part of my brain, which is a wonderful place to be. I'm a big believer in thinking your way through. I love this, Charlie. Event plus one's reaction equals the outcome. So the event, that was horrible. For a long time, it was horrible. And my way of coping with it was to have the best life that I could. And the outcome is that I'm having the best life that I could have. So, but I really like that. It's E plus R, your response, equals the outcome.
So it is event plus response is the outcome.
Yep, now, equals the outcome.
How do you deal with the onslaught of emotions that are coming on in the midst of this cognitive application? There are emotions that are work here.
Oh yeah. Yep. I have a wonderful, empathetic husband. He and I met when we were 14, and he came from a really toxic family with alcoholism, and so he gets me. So he's a safe zone. So I could be vulnerable and little. And when it came to me, there was a lot of publicity around this. It was if it was the cover story of the Los Angeles Times Magazine. I was a whole hour on Oprah. So more and more people contacted us, people that my dad had hurt when they were little. Our little friends is what I'm saying. And that just put me over the top. I was a ball in the kitchen on the floor keening over the fact that our little friends weren't safe at my house. So, yeah, there was a flood of emotion.
Would you say that there's a danger, or I'm going to take that back, that there is a detriment to just keeping it to yourself without having a confidant to share it with, someone that can understand you, that can give you hope, that can give you courage?
Well, here's the thing, Charlie, and for the survivors out there, it's like one in three little girls or one in four or five little boys have been abused. A lot of times if you tell, that person wants to solve it right then. We're going to the authorities. We're going to do this. And the victim may by no means be in a psychological place to go do something about it. And so that's a very a hard thing when the person that you confide in all of a sudden wants to take this massive action.
Wants to be a savior.
Yeah, we got to be really careful. The person hearing this needs to be one who can just listen and not try to solve something. It's very important.
Boy, that is the cardinal rule of listening, and yet, half of communication should be listening, and a tenth of communication is listening, and the rest is responding or thinking of a response while someone is communicating rather than trying to fully embrace what they are saying. That's brilliant advice, Donna. I really like that.
Well, it's just so important. And I have different people contact me because now their niece has told them, and she won't do anything about it. And I go, just let her be. She's not ready. And a lot of times it's not safe to do something about it. Let's take a story where the young woman tells her mom, and the mom says, yes, honey, I hear you. But if we do anything about this, we'll lose the house because dad's the breadwinner. I mean, there are so many layers of meaning and trouble out there that this is something that needs to be done with great cautiousness and with, really thinking out. You can tell that now this starts to be more emotional for me. Do you see, thinking about holding in the secret and all of that? Plus, I had to walk away from all those dogs, and then the cat was meowing at me.
The issues of life, as much as we try to attempt to, and on shows like mine, not too often, we try to simplify. Here is the simple answer. Here's the result.
Yeah.
And life is just far too complex to have simple solutions, that there are so many consequences, so many people involved.
So many consequences, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm amazed that you can come out of that you had the wherewithal as a young child to deal with it, and now you can look back at those times. You are influenced by the negativity, but it is not what owns you.
It doesn't own me, but it did drive me to really, really celebrate the life that I'm living, to really celebrate every day and not take any of it for granted. So it's so much a part of who I am, And I don't know if I had the chance to go back and have a different life, if I would want to choose a different life, because this is who I am. There's been a fire in my belly always to move forward and be the best person I can and see the full technicolor of life. And had I not had that darkness, I don't know that I would see the full technicolor of life like I do. So.
That is, I can identify. There's so many things that you're saying I can identify myself with I can't identify with sexual abuse, but I had a childhood of rejection and abandonment and did not have a good father figure. But I think not having a good father figure taught me what not to do with my son and made me a much better father figure with my son, knowing this is what was necessary, this is what was needed.
Yes, you do the opposite. So
would I change my history? No, because my history is what made me who I am today, gave me the character, the groundedness, the desire. And
maybe the empathy, Charlie. You don't have
my
to be
goodness.
Doing this. You could be playing golf. You don't need to be running around finding guests and dealing with some really hard topics like this. But you have empathy, and honestly, you want to do good for the world, and this is a way of doing good for the world.
That's kind of you to say, but I'll tell you, I could be playing golf, but I'm much better off at podcasts than I am at golf. In sort of wrapping up our time together, something that you stated to me, we chatted yesterday, and something you stated to me is sort of a conclusion to all that we've been discussing. And I found that after all this, the wonderful images of the idyllic nostalgia, the tragedy of sexual abuse, and just the issues of life, through all of it, you seem to continue to possess this irrepressible belief that we take our lessons learned in life and then we have a choice to make. And personally, you believe that happiness is a choice. So tell me, Donna, how do you choose happiness in such a troubled world?
Well, I think you don't sit on the sofa and say, well, I choose to be happy today. What we need to do, what I believe, is be actors in our own life. I am crazy for that Mahaley Sense Mahaley, author of that book, Flow. He's been out at the Claremont Colleges.
Right.
Or he was last time I checked. I don't know even if he's still living. But what he did is he beepered people, a whole book on the, but he put beepers on, this was before cell phones, and had people self-report, what are you doing, and you tell me your range of happiness. His conclusion, when people were in the flow of doing something meaningful to them, they were at their happiness. And so my Growing Up Venice book, the flow of writing, and it wasn't always easy. There are technical things. And then it turns out that the Venice sign is trademarked. So the Venice Chamber of Commerce wanted, I needed to pay a fee because I infringed their trademark. I mean, it wasn't easy. Nothing is so easy, but the feeling of accomplishment to peel away and come up with a new piece of history and a beautiful book, and to live in the past like that and have a sensitivity for the act of the flow experience of doing something like training for a marathon or the movie people say, well, I finished my movie and now what? I was so excited while I was doing it. It's that flow experience of moving forward, involved in work or a project that seems important to us. It's Viktor Frankl all over again.
Right.
Why do some of the strong prisoners in the concentration camps flourish or perish when some of the skinniest, weakest of us were able to live through it?
And for listeners, that book is Man's Search for Meaning.
Absolutely. The answer was you've got to have a purpose. You've got to have a purpose. So
you know,
work
that,
towards your purpose.
And I can give a personal illustration of that. When I retired at 65, I had to retire because of overt anxiety attacks, and I could no longer do my job. And I went through 2 years of not knowing what to do. What do you do without a full calendar? When you're used to a full calendar, you're used to being needed, you're used to being productive, and I had to deal, and it was 2 years, and producer Paul can tell you, I went through those of feelings of boredom and uselessness. And then when I found my charity, Wells of Life, and I found my web presence with The Next Chapter with Charlie, And my psychiatrist, which I continue to visit, not oh so regularly, but we see each other every 2 months. But he said, and I love this phrase, Don, and you'll get it. He says, a busy Charlie is a happy Charlie.
That's right. And a busy Donna. So now I'm rooting around. What's the next thing I'm going to write about? I'm thinking the indigenous people. That's what I, and I don't just mean South Orange County indigenous people. I'm thinking of California, all of California indigenous people. And then maybe I'll shine a light more on LA. But I think busy us in work that we believe is meaningful, not busy work, not
precisely.
Nothing, you know, not just lightweight, like pulling the weeds in the yard. No, I mean real work.
That you're contributing, you know,
secret.
Aristotle said the purpose of humankind is to contribute to the value of society. And
yep.
And if we are contributing to the value of society, of our neighbors, of our friends, of our loved ones, then our life has meaning. Then we then we have a legacy, and it's not a legacy. I love to put it this way. It's not a legacy of me, it's not a legacy of Donna or Charlie, it's a legacy of the impact we have left, of the difference that we have left on people's lives. Whether we get personally attributed to it or not makes no difference. That's not the point. The point is the people that it impacts. And as long as we are impacting people, we're contributing to the value of our life.
Exactly. 9 years of working as a grief counselor, and that showed it right there, using my childhood, the empathy that I felt, and it allowed me to listen to them, and that was important work that I did.
You are an endless flow of energy, are you not? Oh my goodness! I'm so impressed. So, Dr. Donna Fries, thank you so much for spending time with me today. You own such treasured and powerful stories. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Yeah. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. Be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.